This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. In our Declaration of Independence, there's a short list of our unalienable rights. Among them is the pursuit of happiness. Seems we're often pursuing happiness. How often do we achieve it? Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert says we're not very good at predicting what will make us happy. He says we're more likely to stumble onto happiness, thus the title of his book, Stumbling on Happiness. On the program today, we'll take a look at happiness and its pursuit. Daniel Gilbert is our guest. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Perhaps you have a story to share about happiness and its pursuit. You can join us with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Daniel Gilbert is Harvard College Professor of Psychology at Harvard University. He's won recognition for his teaching and research, including the American Psychological Association's Distinguished Scientific Award for an Early Career Contribution to Psychology. He also writes short stories. They have been published in magazines and anthologies, including Amazing Stories and Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. One more thing. I suspect our guest, Daniel Gilbert, is a pretty happy guy. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to talk with us. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Gilbert, how are you?
I'm doing just swell, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much. You know, the pursuit of happiness involves imagining the future, and this is a very wonderful thing, but there are limits to our abilities to see what lies around the next corner. And by way of illustrating the point early in your book, Stumbling on Happiness, you write about optical illusions. Would you talk about that?
Well, you know, the kinds of illusions that happen when we try to project ourselves into the future and imagine what will happen and how happy we'll be if it does are very much like the kinds of illusions that we have when we perceive the world around us. In my book, I describe three basic human faculties. One is retrospection, that's memory, looking backward. One is prospection, or imagination, that lets us look forward. And the other one is perception, which lets us look outward. It turns out that all three of these psychological faculties have a lot in common. And one of the things they have in common is the kinds of biases or mistakes to which they're prone.
And why are those biases built in?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, why are they built in? It's certainly with regard to vision, we understand why these biases and mistakes occur. We understand what's going wrong with the visual system when it sees two parallel lines converging on the horizon. But I think the bigger and deeper question is, you know, why we have biases, why we make mistakes when we look into our own futures and try to estimate what will make us happy. And we do. And there's lots of research, both experimental and field research from fields as far-flung as psychology, behavioral economics, cognitive neuroscience, and all of that's summarized in the book, which is, you know, really an attempt to say what it is that all of these sciences have taught us over the last 10 years about why human beings are so poor at looking into the future and predicting the sources of their own satisfaction.
Mm. Now, you're upfront about this book not being a self-help book, but by thinking about happiness, might we not become a little wiser about it?
Well, I certainly hope so. You're right. It's not a self-help book in the sense of, any book with happiness is the third word in the title, risks being seen as a self-help book. It's not because it's not a book that says, here's a program to make yourself happier. It's a book that says, the human brain is the most complex object in the known universe, and it doesn't come with an owner's manual. But scientists have been writing one, and they're trying very much to get a sense of how this thing works. And here's a little piece of that owner's manual. Here's a chapter. This book will make you smarter about happiness. It will tell you what the best minds of this century know and think and have discovered about it. Now, knowledge is power. So with that in mind, can you lead a happier life? I certainly hope so. But there's no promises. You know, you open by reminding us that our Constitution gives us three inalienable rights. Do you notice that it gives us the right to life and liberty, but it doesn't give us happiness. It only gives us the right to chase it. Well, that shows a great deal of wisdom, because that's the one thing the founders of our country really couldn't promise us. The other thing I think you should note about the Constitution is that the first two of these things that were guaranteed are only worthwhile because they bring us the third. So really, it's only happiness and its pursuit that anybody cares about guaranteeing or should care about guaranteeing.
Yeah. Here's life, liberty, now go for it.
Exactly. I mean, what good is liberty? Well, liberty's good because it makes people happy. And if it didn't, by God, we wouldn't want it.
Yeah, yeah. I suspect people the world over want to be happy, but is happiness more important in some cultures than in others?
Well, the idea of happiness is more important in some cultures than others. So Americans are unabashed. They're not ashamed to say, of course I'm pursuing happiness. If you go to Russia, people say, if you're pursuing happiness, you're stupid. You know, well, who cares about happiness? I actually think everybody cares about happiness. I think they care about happiness equally. But I think there are cultural norms about what one should and shouldn't say is an important part of life. And, you know, Americans are very happy to say that happiness is an important part of their life. But I think it's not only true that, you know, everybody experiences and values happiness. I think it's even further than our own species. We understand where in the brain happiness is generated. Mm. And it's a part of your brain you share with every other mammal. You know, there's lots of the part of your brain, by the way, that looks forward in time and figures out what will make you happy is almost uniquely human. But the part of the brain that actually creates the experience of happiness is widely shared. So my guess is that any animal with this particular brain region, the limbic system, is able to experience happiness like you and I can.
Yeah, well, that's why our dog jumps for joy.
There's no doubt in my mind that dogs experience happiness, but there's grave doubt in my mind that they ever look forward to the next week's happiness. They never say, I think I'll save this for later because it would be good, and you know, I'll be tired tomorrow and I won't want to chase after this bone, so let me get two now. Dogs don't plan like that. They just get happy when the bone is there. Human beings can plan, yeah, but they can only plan wisely if they really understand what is going to bring them happiness and what isn't. And it turns out the data suggests we're not very good at that.
Yeah. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us who's on a cell phone in Watsika. Line 4, you're on the air with Daniel Gilbert.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I agree. I have my own story to share, and then I'll go ahead and ring off. But I do think we have a tendency of looking at happiness as a very complex thing, and whereas really I think the key is the simple things in life. And well, my story is a couple of years ago, my wife and I packed our two kids off to a vacation. We were going to spend 3 days in New York and 3 days in Disney World. And what we found when we were in the midst of that is that we were running full speed to try to enjoy the moment, but we didn't want to miss anything. So instead of enjoying what we were doing currently, you know, we were like, well, we got to do this tomorrow, we got to do this tomorrow, we got to run to the plane and go to New York and blah, blah, blah. And it was too hot, too expensive, too many people. And, you know, we thought, well, this was a good thing to do with the kids. And what I've been doing on the weekends is I take the kids and the dog and we go, we live in a rural area, and we go, you know, to a farm or, you know, cross the stream, scare up some wild animals. And it's absolutely delightful. And the kids enjoy it. And I was thinking, what were we thinking about, you know, spending all this money, going here, going there, fighting the crowds and the traffic. It's something you can't buy as well planned out as you try. It's you have to be ready for happiness at the moment and the simple things in life. All the planning and all expense you think is, you know, you're going to buy this vacation that's going to bring you happiness. And it's really not part of the equation. But unfortunately, we had to learn the hard way. So I just thought I'd share that. So thank you.
Thanks for the story.
Yeah, it's a great story, and it's got lots of elements in it that would, make a scientist smile, because so many of the things that the gentleman was saying ring true and are true. So, for example, we know that one of the best predictors of a person's daily happiness is the frequency and not the intensity of their positive experiences. Think about that. It's the number and not how big they are. And what he was talking about was a premier vacation, an event that would last a short time, but would be off scale in terms of happiness. Well, even if Disney World had worked out the way he had thought it was going to, it wouldn't have increased his general happiness in life over the course of months or years as much as spending that same amount of money on a number of smaller good things, not quite as intense, but more of them. So people often ask me, well, you know, what's the what's the best thing about being a professor at Harvard? And I don't know what the best thing is, but I know the second best thing is that I can walk to work. And the reason it's such a good thing isn't because it makes me ecstatic when I do it. It's because it happens twice a day, every day, reliably. And over time, the fact that I only have to live two blocks from my office gives me a great deal more happiness than some fantastic experience might.
Yeah.
The other thing he mentioned that I thought was really worth commenting on was when he thought about the vacation, what he forgot was the vacation is about the kids and the family. It's not about the giant Mickey Mouse, and it's not about the airplanes. We know that one of the very best predictors of a person's happiness, when I say we, I mean scientists, I don't mean me in general, me in particular, we know that one of the very best predictors is a person's social relationships. We're social mammals. We're happy when we're interacting with people we like and who like us back. That is the biggest source of joy in almost any human life. This vacation should have been about maximizing the interaction that he had with the kids and the positivity of that interaction, not the things they were doing, not the activities. Activities that help our social interactions are activities that make us happy, but activities that are substitutes for social interaction tend not to.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that there has been some study, you would know this better than I believe, of support groups for folks and people who have suffered some cataclysmic event or illness. If you are part of a support group, you do better generally than people who don't have a social network.
That makes perfectly good sense to me. I mean, there's a finding that perplexed psychologists and sociologists for some time. We know that religious people are happier than non-religious people. And one theory about that, and I think the theory most people would hold, is that it's very comforting to have religious beliefs, to believe that there's a hereafter, to believe that there's a loving God who's looking after you. All of these are things that would make anyone happy. Well, it turns out that's not the part of religion that makes people happy. It's not that it makes them unhappy, but it doesn't significantly increase their happiness. What part does? Community. It's not the religion. It's the church. It's the group of other people with whom you're participating in an activity that's meaningful to you, people who care about you, who care if you get ill, etc. It all comes back to social relationships.
Hmm. As you point out in the book, in a couple of examples fairly early on, happiness is quite a subjective experience. Maybe here you would tell us about the conjoined twins, Reba and Lori.
Well, happiness is only a subjective experience, in fact. I don't know what the word would mean if we weren't referring to a feeling that each of us has. And I know what that feeling is, and you know what it is, but it's like Potter Stewart, the Supreme Court Justice, who said, I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it. We can't define happiness, except we all know it when we're feeling it. So it's entirely a subjective experience. But what's so odd is how poor we are at predicting what kinds of circumstances would bring it about and which kind would preclude it. You mentioned the conjoined twins, and I do open a chapter by talking about a really remarkable pair of conjoined twins who they're locked together face-to-face. They have been for their entire lives, of course, and they're very happy people. And what's odd about that, from our point of view, is that we can't imagine being happy in their circumstances. But as it turns out, they're very typical of conjoined twins. So what's wrong here? Well, what's wrong here is that we're experiencing a failure of imagination. We are failing to realize that in their position, we would be as happy as they are. Our inability to empathize, if you will, with these people is exactly the same inability we have when we try to empathize with our future selves.
Hmm. You've mentioned scientists now from a number of disciplines. Can we measure happiness then? How do we go about investigating it?
What a wonderful question. Yes, we can measure happiness. And in fact, it's not even hard. You know, measuring helium, that's hard. Measuring the weight of helium, measuring the size of Jupiter, that's the hard kind of science that takes a lot of very special metal instruments and really smart people who understand circuitry. Happiness is very easy to measure. Why? Because people can report on it reliably. As long as the circumstances are such that people are willing to be candid, that is, that they're not motivated to tell you what's not true, people can tell you how happy they are feeling at the moment you ask the question. Now, you know, some people kind of shake their heads when I say this, and they go, well, I'm not sure that I think, you know, what a person says about their internal states is really a reliable bit of data for science. And my reply to that is, well, not only you should throw away my book, but you should also throw away your glasses, because the science of optometry is based on exactly the same kinds of data. No machines can measure your eyes, but they cannot tell what you're seeing. Only you can report to your optometrist what you're seeing. And so your optometrist is a good investigator who gives you different things to look at and says, is this one clearer? Is that one clearer? Is this one bent? Is this one distorted? And on the basis of your answers of what it's like to see, what it seems like to you, your optometrist is able to create a lens that perfectly corrects your vision. That's science. I mean, that's a wonderful bit of science, that lens, and it comes out of nothing but your report of your subjective experience. If we can grind lenses to correct vision on the basis of your report of your experience, why in the world would we not take your report of your own happiness at face value? We do, and that's the science, that's the kind of the basic data for the science of happiness.
Mm. I'll take the rose-colored.
Yeah, the rose-colored glasses are very nice, and it's really important to notice, though, that rose-colored glasses, though rose-colored, are not opaque. That is, they still allow you to see. So, you know, we all have a tendency, and I talk about this quite a bit in my book, to see the world through rose-colored glasses, to rationalize, if you will, to find the most positive spin to put on events, but not so much so that we're deluded. You know, rose-colored glasses can't be blinders.
Yeah. Well, they're easy enough to run over with a car, too. You know, when we imagine things, when we imagine the future, which is something that we have this wonderful capability to do, often we look forward to something pleasurable, but we might also think about something that's coming up that we're just dreading. On both counts, though, it seems that this is something that is good for us. It provides us with a comfort zone of sorts.
Well, it's certainly true that we look forward to both positive and negative events, and we make mistakes when we look forward to both kinds of events. But what science suggests is the bigger mistake is with negative events. As wrong as people are about what will make them happy, they're dreadfully wrong about what will make them unhappy and how unhappy it will make them. The form of this error is very clear. People, by and large, overestimate how bad they'll feel and how long they'll feel bad in the face of adversity. So tons of data show that people who experience tragedies and traumas of every size, from the most mundane, you know, not getting the lunch we wanted, to the most serious, losing family members, living through hurricanes, by and large, people do remarkably well. We admire people like Christopher Reeve, who, you know, seemed to overcome quadriplegia to be a happy guy. And we admire him as if he were a rarity. He's not a rarity, it turns out. It turns out that most people who are quadriplegic or paraplegic are relatively happy people. Human beings are, I know it sounds like a country song, but we do pretty darn good when things go pretty darn bad. And the only really interesting question is why we don't know this about ourselves, why we think we are fragile flowers who will wilt when the first, you know, ill wind blows our way, when in fact the data are very clear that people fare quite well in the face of almost every kind of adversity. This doesn't mean everybody, mm-hmm. but it means most people most of the time.
Well, that's a great question. Why is it so that we think we are these fragile little flowers?
You know, it's a great question, and it's got some great answers. I think the main answer to it is we severely underestimate our capacity to change the way we will see the world once a bad thing happens to us. So if you ask somebody, you know, how devastated would you be and for how long if your husband or wife were to run off to, you know, Morocco with your best friend? The obvious answer is, oh, my gosh, I'd be terribly devastated. I'd be devastated for years and years to come. Why? Because you're imagining the husband or wife you currently have. What you don't realize is that the moment they run off to Morocco, they stop becoming that husband or wife. They start becoming somebody else entirely, somebody with whom you might not have actually had that many interests, somebody who maybe we got married a little too early, somebody who never really thought about me and put themselves first. You can hear me, you know, narrating the stream of consciousness of somebody who's rationalizing.
Right.
We're very good rationalizers. All of us are. But we don't seem to know this about ourselves. We know it about our friends. That's why we say things like, oh, he'll get over it. There's other fish in the sea. Because we recognize that our friends are going to find ways to think about the bad events that happen to them that make them feel a little better. We just don't seem to recognize that we are among the human beings who do this too.
Yeah. And that brings to mind the role of memory, or the fact of memory, and how it's pretty faulty.
You know, memory is faulty, and why should we be concerned about it? You know, psychologists might want to be, but why should a book that has to do with looking into the future and trying to gauge happiness, what does that have to do with memory? Well, the question is, why don't we learn from our past mistakes? And all the things we've been talking about, the kinds of mistakes people make when they, you know, imagine the future and try to think what will make them happy, should be mistakes that get cured with experience, shouldn't they? By the time you're, well, my age at least, you should have become a happiness expert and really figured out what the sources of happiness are for you. And it turns out people make the same mistakes over and over again. Why? Well, because to learn from your experience, you have to be able to remember it. Can we remember our experience? Well, yes, we all know where we lived in 1987. We might remember our phone number from 1991, but it turns out people are very poor at remembering how they felt in the past. They tend to make the same error in retrospection that they make in prospection. So people will say, if this bad thing happens, I'm going to be really devastated for a long time. Years later, they will tell you, when that bad thing happened, I was really devastated for a long time. That doesn't sound like a problem, except if there's a scientist there to measure how they felt, they actually weren't devastated, and not for nearly as long as they thought. So memory shares some of imagination's biases, and these two critters kind of reinforce each other's mistakes.
Is it also tied up in how we learn?
How we learn about
what, you know, I get a cue for a certain thing that's going to happen. And so I based on past experience, I say, I've learned this.
Yes, exactly. I mean, your past experience teaches you that some things made you happy and some didn't. And it, you know, don't get me wrong. It's not that a past experience is entirely mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
We can remember to some extent what the good things are and what the bad things are. And that's, you know, why very few of us put our fingers in a beehive twice. You know, we get it. That hurt.
Yeah.
That wasn't much fun. But we do make mistakes around the margin. We do fail to remember just how happy we were and just how long that happiness lasted. And so we can end up making similar mistakes again and again and again. You know, family vacations are a great example. It's where we started with our first caller. And I don't know about you, but I often have the experience of leaving family gatherings, slapping my head and asking myself, why didn't I remember that last year this same thing happened and I swore I wasn't coming back? And here I am again as if, you know, I'd experienced some kind of annual amnesia. Well, it really isn't amnesia. It's just the failure of memory to properly remember what makes us happy in the past.
Yeah. I heard a wonderful story a few days back. A little boy, this was his mother telling this story, a little boy, 5 years old, celebrating his birthday. There were three presents, and they were given to this little boy during the course of the afternoon picnic at the family house. And so the first present came, and with each present, the little one was told, close your eyes. So first present is unwrapped. It's a soccer ball. Okay. Some time goes on. Close your eyes again. Okay. Another package is opened. It's something with SpongeBob SquarePants. And finally, the birthday present is waiting in the garage, and it's time to close your eyes once again. And you go into the garage. This little guy goes into the garage, and it is something he's been asking for months. It's a bicycle. And he is so happy. And the afternoon goes on, but it's not too much longer. And this little guy comes to Mom and Dad and says, you know, I think it's time for me to close my eyes again. Isn't that a great story?
Yeah, he's figured out
what makes
presents happen.
Yeah, yeah. And he's imagining, you know, and it's I just thought that was such a great story.
Yeah, children do, you know, they do just what adults do. They close their eyes and imagine and try to think about what would make them happy. But like adults, they're also susceptible to a lot of misinformation. So, you know, on the subject of children, you ask anybody who's a parent, and that's most adults, what's their greatest source of happiness, and they quickly say their children. Well, that's all well and good, except if you look at the data. If you actually look at data from economics or psychology, there are virtually no studies showing that children increase people's happiness. Some studies show it; they don't make much of a difference. Other studies show that they create a slightly negative effect, and other studies show that they create a dramatic negative effect. So the truth is somewhere between negative and nothing, but there's almost no data to suggest that children actually make us happy. So the hard question is, why do we think they do if in fact they don't? Is there something wrong with us, or is there something wrong with these data? I think there's something wrong with us. I think there are foibles of memory and foibles of imagination that explain why we have this belief that our children are a great source of happiness. Don't get me wrong, I've got one. And in fact, I've even got a grandchild, and I believe, like every listener, that these people are the greatest sources of happiness for me. But the data that I look at as a scientist suggests I'm experiencing some kind of fundamental delusion.
Daniel Gilbert is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's a psychologist on the faculty of Harvard University, and he is the author of Stumbling on Happiness. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments about happiness and its pursuit. Give us a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Eureka, line 4. Hi.
Hi. Very interesting program. I believe I heard you on Charlie Rose several weeks ago, and it was a fascinating interview. I saved it in videotape. Anyway, I was thinking about when you were talking about the processes of maybe repeating the same mistake over and over again, or trying to ascertain what is pain like and going through painful things. I thought of two psychologists that have been helpful to me. One is Martin E.P. Seligman, the University of Pennsylvania, who talks about optimism. And I believe, for the sake maybe just oversimplifying, in learned optimism, he says that the people who look on it as temporary seem to survive versus those who have a kind of permanent state. And also he emphasizes very, very much in a kind of self-therapeutic role of arguing yourself out of some of your inaccurate thoughts. And also Aaron T. Beck and David Burns were you know, in cognitive psychology, it seems. And I think there is something to that, that quite often we part of our problem is we believe our own thoughts. We take them to be complete reality, maybe without having a check on those. And again, I believe both Beck and Burns argue for a kind of viewing them through definitions of, at least Burns, maybe 10 cognitive distortions, and I guess Beck is 12, but they argue about using a kind of arguing yourself out of them. Could you comment on that aspect, please?
Well, sure. I mean, the people you're naming are all esteemed psychologists, and they have lots of important and interesting things to say. They're a different flavor of psychologist than I am. That is, these are clinical psychologists. Uh-huh. These are people who deal with people and their emotional problems and therapy, etc. We both share the name psychologist, but I'm the other kind. I'm the kind that actually does experiments in laboratories on human beings and looks at how they process information and how they feel. So I'm not expert to comment on any of the particulars of their, you know, therapeutic approaches. What I will say is what they share in common with what we might call a scientific or experimental psychology is the belief that people aren't reacting to external circumstances. They're reacting to their construal or their understanding of the circumstances. It's not what happens to us in life that determines our happiness. It's how we think about what happens to us in life. And the simplest example of that is if your spouse says, don't forget your umbrella. Well, you know, if you hear that as nagging, then you get angry. And if you hear that as caring, then you feel overjoyed. It isn't the utterance itself that's creating your emotional response. It's what you're thinking about or how you're thinking about the utterance. One of the things we know is that people have some control over how they think about things, but they underestimate how much control they have. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons that we make mistakes about how happy we'll be in the future is we assume we're going to be the complete victims of the circumstances in which we find ourselves. We say, how happy would I be if I went blind? Why, I'd be miserable. Well, it turns out that there are actually ways to think about this kind of experience that make it not so bad, that might even make it kind of good. But what you don't recognize in prospect is that you have the ability to change your view of being blind from the one you currently have now as a sighted person to the one that most people who are blind have about their condition. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, I find it interesting that if you ask sighted people, you know, name the 10 worst things about being blind, they don't name the single thing that most blind people say is the worst. What is that? They say, everyone thinks I'm sad. That's the worst thing about being blind, is all you people who are sighted think this is a terrible thing and I must be depressed, and I'm not.
Mm-hmm. Could I mention one more thing, please?
Sure.
I know, is it Epictetus, the Greek philosopher? Burns and both Beck mention, which sort of talked about what you say, which tends to lead me to think that they really are on the right track for a lot of ordinary things. That I think it's the quote, it's not so much what happens, it's the view of how you view things that really make the difference. And,
yeah.
I think, again, at least for Burns, the number of distortions people have about thinking about things. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Do you want to follow up there?
No, I think he was reaffirming what Epictetus and Seligman and Beck and he and I and probably everyone listening already agrees with.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. Caller in Indiana, line one. Hi.
Hello. Following this, had a number of memories. And a number of things you said seemed awful counterintuitive to me. And one in particular is the last one about children making us happy. And you said, when I look at the studies, I see that's not true. I'd like for you to tease out these studies. I don't think that I'm that unique that I can remember things about my children and all that sort of thing. It still makes me happy when I bring them back to consciousness. And somehow that just seemed counterintuitive to me. And I know if I was in your class, I'd be standing up yelling and screaming about it. show me the data and let me make sure that you're interpreting it correctly, because that's it's almost counterintuitive with capital C and capital I. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about that in particular. And in a sense, could you generally fit this into the behaviorist and non-behaviorist boys in psychology too? Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call.
I agree with the caller. It is counterintuitive with a big giant C. I mean, that's what makes it such an interesting problem from the point of view of science. This is science telling us something that absolutely defies our own intuitions and our own memories. And so, you know, one reaction you might have, and I think that many people have, is to say, well, come on, those data must be silly. There's something wrong with those studies. But think about many of the other things that science has told us that are absolutely counterintuitive, but that we've actually come to accept. So right now I'm standing on the 14th floor of a building, and I'm looking out the window, and I'm telling you, the world's flat. I mean, I can see it from here. There's no ball. There's no curve. It's totally flat. For the longest time, when scientists said, no, it's actually a globe, people said, show us the data. I can't believe that. That's too counterintuitive. Right now, I don't see anything between me and my bookshelf, but science tells me there's germs that are invisible and they're floating around, and some of them are even bad enough to kill me. That's pretty counterintuitive, and yet we've come to believe it. So there's often a trade-off between the data and our own intuitions, and it doesn't mean our intuitions are right and the data are wrong. It could be the other way around. So let's assume that maybe in this case that's a possibility and that we're all open to being convinced that our intuitions are wrong. Why would our caller remember so many moments of happiness with his children? Well, first of all, there were many moments of happiness. To say that they don't increase your happiness in general is not to say that there are no moments of happiness. It's just to say that on average, they're creating a negative effect rather than a positive effect on happiness. That's what the data suggests. But one of the things we know from our... I'm sorry, have we gotten disconnected?
No.
Oh, okay, good. I'm hearing little beeps on the phone. I just want to make sure you were still there. Otherwise, I'm talking to myself, and then I have to call another psychologist. One of the things that we know about memory is that it loves unusual and atypical circumstances. So if you mention my child's name and say, remember childhood, there's particular moments that come to mind. You know, he's in a school play, and he's beaming out at me, and he's happy, and I'm happy. Well, it turns out these are unusual moments that most of the time that I spent as a parent, I was probably spending in the selfless service of a person who would maybe someday be begrudgingly grateful for what I had done. Most of the moments of parenting aren't particularly pleasant. Look, there's a recent study done by a Nobel laureate in which 800 women were tracked throughout their days as they did all of their daily activities, and their happiness was constantly measured. Now, this enabled the scientists to figure out what kinds of activities gave rise to the most happiness and what gave rise to the least. What's at the top of the list? Well, things you would expect. Having sex with a spouse, hanging out with friends. These are all sources of great happiness for people. A little lower in the list, things like watching television. Even lower in the list, doing housework. What's right underneath doing housework? Any interaction with your own children. Now, if you'd stopped those mothers at the end of the study and said, what's your greatest source of joy? Oprah? Sex? Or children? They go, oh, you're out of here. Of course it's children. Well, maybe sex, but it's certainly children are way, way up there. But the data suggests they're wrong, that they're having a delusion about what their sources of happiness are.
Yeah, sometimes we get caught up with, you know, and this is something that you talk about with the twins. You know, be honest, not correct.
Yep.
And if we're honest about it, we go, oh, yeah.
Now, this doesn't mean we shouldn't have kids or we should right. say, hey, you know, I thought they were making me happy. I'm going to go, you know, flush them all down the toilet and get rid of the kids.
No,
that doesn't mean that at all. What it means is that anybody who is having children expecting that this will increase their moment-to-moment daily happiness is likely to be mistaken. They're likely to find out that this isn't so.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I clipped three things you could do to get happier from the Sunday Times last October. I thought you'd be interested. One was one exercise involves writing down three things that went well and why every day for a week. Another is identifying your signature strengths and using one of them in a new and different way every day for a week. And third thing you can do is to write a long letter to someone who's to whom you've been grateful but have never properly thanked, and then visit that person and read it to him in person. Any comments?
Well, I think I know where all three of those came from, and my guess is that they're all actually based on good data, that they're actually based on studies, somebody's idea of what happiness is and ought to be. So I would have faith in all three of these suggestions. How much of an improvement one gets in happiness, I don't know. The last one I find particularly intriguing because there are some data to suggest that people vastly underestimate how happy altruistic acts will make them. And I guess we could think of writing a gratitude letter as an altruistic act. Turns out, you know, many people ask me, gosh, you're only concerned with human happiness. Doesn't that seem kind of selfish? And the answer is no. One of the greatest sources of human happiness is not being selfish. When we do kind things for other people, it brings great happiness to us. So I wouldn't quibble with any of those three suggestions.
Yeah, very good. And also, I just recently read that they were... some study came out that people who are married, that when the partner is happy, that makes the other partner happy, but that only works in a marriage, which is kind of a little bit of what you were talking about. But talking about marriage, and I had one last thing I wanted to ask you about, that recently they reported, apparently, in a journal called Social Forces, that they were talking about what makes women happy about their marriage, and they cite two things. I don't know if they were the top two things or not, but anyway, they said woman's marital bliss, one of the key ingredients is her husband's emotional commitment, and this is apparently based on 5,000 couples. And the other thing is that, and this is the funny one because it has something to do with, you know, how the general idea is that money won't make you happy. But according to this study, at least, women whose husbands bring home more than 68% of the bacon are the most content. And I was wondering if you'd comment on that, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, you know, neither of those surprised me. In fact, wouldn't we be a little surprised if it went the other way around, that a woman's happiness is uninfluenced by her husband's happiness, and wouldn't we be surprised if it turned out that women were less happy the more money was coming into the household? So I guess neither of those surprised me very much. I guess maybe the most important thing to know about marriage and happiness is that marriage has a net positive effect on happiness. Virtually every study shows this. Married people are happier than non-married people. So I like to throw that in because I've done all this ranting about children not being a source of happiness. You might imagine that I'm for everybody going up and sitting in their cave all alone. Not to be the case at all. Marriage is a wonderful institution that makes people happy, and then children come along and wreck it. I'm being glib, of course.
I know.
It's not far from the truth.
I know, but you're making us smile, and that makes us happy.
Good.
One more thing about kids, and that is something that you talk about in the book, and I think what is involved here is the concept that you present called presentism. You know, the imagined future looks an awful lot like the present, so it's hard to imagine, you know, what we're going to do with the children that we want to have. It's hard to see, you know, the future in that, you know, where we are where we are.
You know, presentism, probably a better example even than children of presentism, which is the tendency to, imagine the future as though it were the present, is shopping on a full or an empty stomach. We've all had this experience. Yeah. We go to the grocery store and we're just ravenous because we failed to eat that day or the last few hours, and we start shopping for the week ahead of us. And what do? Well, we buy all sorts of stuff we don't really want, right? We look at the bok choy and we start salivating and we bring home a bundle of it. And then somehow Monday morning rolls around and we open up the fridge and go, what do I have bok choy for? And the answer is the reason you have it is it looked good at the time and therefore you imagined you would want it in the future. It's very hard to escape our present emotional states when we're making predictions about the future. That's why people are absolutely convinced that they can quit smoking right after they've had a cigarette, because at the moment they're not feeling a craving. It's hard for them to imagine that tomorrow, if they didn't have a cigarette, they would feel a craving. This is why people propose marriage while on shore leave. There are lots of, highly volatile emotional states that we're in, and when we make predictions about the future when we're in those states, we almost always err in the direction of our current emotional state.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
Seemed like a good idea. It sounded good, say, right?
Yeah.
Sounded good at the time, and indeed it would have been good at the time. It's just not very good now.
Yeah, that moment is long gone.
Yep.
Let's take one more call. We'll have to be quick, though. Listener in Effingham, line 4. Hi.
Hi. My quick question has to do with the mass media. It seems like we're talking about people having illusions about happiness. You turn on the TV, and you're constantly being told if you take this diet, you buy these clothes, you buy this food. And what seems like the media plays a large role in shaping our perceptions about what makes us happy. And maybe that has something to do with why people are constantly making mistakes about their happiness. And secondly, a lot of people tend to emphasize spiritual happiness or intellectual fulfillment over physical happiness. And is there any data to support one being better than the other?
Yeah, these are great questions, and they're even interrelated. Of course, yes, we're being bombarded all the time with messages about what will make us happy, from toothpaste to cars, etc. All of these have underlying them these presupposition that stuff can make us happy if only we can figure out what the right stuff is. By and large, this tends not to be true. Now, I say by and large because there's an important caveat. Money does buy happiness when it moves you from poverty to the middle class. Anybody who says money doesn't buy happiness should go interview someone who's living under a bridge. It changes your life dramatically when it buys you out of the burdens of hunger, insecurity, cold, etc. However, once people have their basic needs met, more money tends to be a big old pile of paper. There's diminishing returns on each dollar you earn beyond, say, about $50,000 a year. Now, societies can't function very well if everybody quits working and earning and consuming each other's goods and services the moment they've reached the amount of income that would actually, the amount of wealth that would actually make them happy. Societies like ours need us to constantly strive, to constantly be hungry for more and more and more. That's what keeps economies rolling. So they disguise their need as ours, in a sense. Economies need us to be constant consumers, and so they convince us that this will make us happy. The data are very clear it doesn't.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Professor Daniel Gilbert, a professor of psychology. He is Harvard College Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, and he is the author of Stumbling on Happiness. The publisher is Knopf.